Welcome to the Rust Belt Rundown, brought to you by Rust Belt Recruiting. This podcast is designed to shine a light on the meaningful work being done in Northeast Ohio and the surrounding region. We will convene manufacturing executives and Northeast Ohio business leaders for candid discussions about their business, regional happenings, industry trends, entrepreneurship, and more. Now, let's get running on the Rundown.
Welcome, everyone, to episode 72 of the Rust Belt Rundown, a production by Workforce LLC. I'm your host, Paul O'Connor, and on this episode, we are joined by Bob Fussinger, the Chief Financial Officer at Ramco Specialties. Bob, welcome to the podcast. Happy you're here.
Thank you, Paul. I appreciate it. I'm excited to be a guest on the podcast and looking forward to our chat.
So you're going to be, before we dive in, you're going to be the third or fourth either CFO or someone high up in the finance world. We're going to get to it, but that I'm always fascinated to talk to people that that part of their brain operates at a high level because mine does not. So we're going to get there. But before we get there, give us the rundown on all things Ramco, what you guys do, who you work with, the 411 on all things Ramco.
Okay. So Ramco is a privately held business, started in 1977 here in Hudson, Ohio. We've been here ever since then. And we have a second facility located in New Hudson, Michigan, that we moved into about this time last year. We consolidated some facilities up there into one facility that gave us more manufacturing space. So we are a provider, a manufacturer and distributor of engineered specialty products. The product is made and purchased, although we just went through a major expansion here at Ramco in Hudson, Ohio, where we added on square footage to total 215,000 square feet. And we bought five additional forming machines in the last year and a half, 2 years, to greatly improve and increase the quantity that we manufacture domestically instead of importing as much from Taiwan.
Awesome. Well, that's super helpful. I appreciate you setting the scene there. I want to switch gears a little bit to talk about your role as a CFO, specifically around how a CFO can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different organizations. Not on the basics, right? I think we're all aligned on, what CFOs are there, to do from a high level standpoint. My question is, how would you describe your role on the senior leadership team as it relates to the day-to-day operations? Because just in my career, the financial leaders of different organizations that I've worked with have plugged and played in different ways. Some of them are leading the org. Some of them are more on the background, making sure that people aren't going over budget and staying within what we said we were going to do and managing expenses. And so I'm curious to see how your role at Ramco, plays out in the day to day.
Okay. Well, being that we're privately held, family owned, so my primary role is, or a big part of my primary role is being the key advisor to the owner, to the president and CEO, including a lot of his personal tax work, that type of thing that I'm intimately involved with to make sure that he's getting the best bang for the tax buck and anything that makes sense for us to be doing a little differently to save him some money, we're doing that. So that's a big part of it. But then the other part that my team and myself work on, you had mentioned the budgets and spending, that type of thing. So lots of reports that we work with operations on so that they know where they're at on their spending. How much are they budgeted to spend? If they need to go over, we're talking about those types of things. From the VP of ops here to the managers of the different supervisors of different departments. that includes a big part of it with the CapEx, especially in the last several years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we I don't even want to mention the number, but it's a huge number that we've put into equipment, buildings, and personnel for what we have going on here now. So, you know, working through all of that has been, you know, a challenge for everybody to understand and make sure that we're getting it in place at the right time and that that machine that we have purchased is up and running quickly. What else do they need to do with it? And how do we make sure that they're getting what they need from an operation standpoint to make that equipment make us money again, to pay back the financing on it? From a CapEx standpoint, also working with, you know, our banks. We have a couple of banks that we work with, local, you know, Greater Cleveland banks, Key Bank and Civista. You know, kudos to both of them. They're great to work with. They, you know exactly what we're doing as far as our expansion plans, what our customers that, you know, that we're working with to grow the business. They know why we're buying equipment. We're very transparent with them, and that's a big part of my job. And then also working with our customers. You know, we sell to OEMs, the big three, and then the tiers, and the OEMs have a financial risk evaluation that you go through with them. And we work very, I work very closely with them to ensure that they understand what's going on with Ramco from a financial standpoint and that we are getting the types of quotes that we want and deserve because we're financially stable, even though we have taken on the debt to finance everything, but it's all laid out so that they can understand we did it for these reasons and that we're meeting up with what their expectations are for a domestic supplier. And then there's also the insurance side of it, you know, PNC insurance and cyber insurance and, you know, just all kinds of things that we make sure that we're having the proper coverages on. You know, we have recall insurance because we're automotive. So if there's a recall that includes a Ramco part, which it hasn't, but we have that type of insurance. So it's working through and making sure we have the right coverages in place for the right types of claims that could occur. And as we grow into different areas, maybe there's a little more risk in one area. We're looking at that recall insurance. We're looking at other types of insurance to make sure we're covered. So that's a big part of the job right there.
So whether it be you mentioned it throughout that a couple different ways, whether it be with the banks or insurance or internal or external, how important is it for people in your position to combine the numbers and the data and the ability to tell a story, you know, that storytelling aspect, because that's where I really need it. Like my weakness is I have many weaknesses. One of them is numbers and data. I need someone to synthesize that, tell me right. What this means, and then we'll make a decision together. How important is mm-hmm. that in your role?
It's very important because when you're going to, you know, when I sit down with the owner, with Rick here, it's telling them the story on what I've learned from operations on why we need to spend this money. Why do we need that piece of equipment? What's it going to do for us? How we're going to get there? What did I consider in it? But it's also getting that out to our partners, the banks, the insurance companies, and telling them that story. It's not just numbers. They get the numbers. You can show them the numbers. But when you start telling them what you're doing and you're very transparent and being open with them and telling them, hey, here's a failure, but here's what we did to fix that. It's important for them to know that they have that comfort because you're providing it to them. My background is a little more unique than a lot of folks because I was very fortunate in my career that I not only worked at a CPA firm right out of college. I'm an inactive CPA, which just means I don't pay the money every year to keep it active because I'm not doing tax returns and attesting financial statements, that type of thing. But I maintain my license as a inactive. But I also went into I worked for Scott Fetzer, part of Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway. And from there, I went to one of the divisions, and the president of that division, Stahl Truck Bodies, down in Worcester, Ohio, which Rust Belt also did some work with, I heard. They're a truck body manufacturer. When I was there, we had four facilities around the country, and I had the opportunity to get very involved in a lot of things operationally, including I was the controller, but then I moved and I added on procurement and I added on special quotations because those were very closely aligned to the cost accounting for the business. Mm-hmm. So if you were getting a good price on your materials, which was steel, paint, hardware like hinges and latches and lighting and that type of thing, you knew where your costs were. And then on the quotation side, you had to know that you had a robust ability to quote. Approximately 40% of the business was special at that time. So it was very important to understand how these quotes were being costed so that we knew that when we were quoting it used to be CEI, Cleveland Electric Illuminating, or the water company, or the tree companies, like a Davy type tree, that we had the right costs in there. And that was very important to me in my career. It helped me really grow a lot. And then from there, I ran the manufacturing plants. I had gotten involved with some teams, profit improvement teams, including hourly, workforce, engineers, the sales team, where we worked on improving the products and the costs so that we could manufacture them, at a lower cost and sell them at a higher margin for the company. And that was very interesting because when I went into it, I had plant managers who had 30, 35, 40 years of experience. And here I was, this mid-30-year-old kid who had never worked in operations running plants and saying, hey, I'm your new boss, but hey, guess what? We're going to do this together. I'm not here to tell you how to do things. I want to learn and I want to help make us, better by providing information and understanding things and how do we invest better into the business to improve the operations. And, I'll say that it worked pretty well. I enjoyed it. I really got engrossed in manufacturing by doing that. And that's what I love too about being here at Ramco with the manufacturing. I like going out and touching something, right? I can see how it's made. I can understand the equipment as far as my little brain works. And then I also ran the Arbortech business, which is the tree truck business that made the trucks that they shoot their chips into when they're trimming trees. Mm-hmm. So, like a Davy tree or the little mom and pop tree company, they have one or two, three, four trucks. And I ran that part of the company and we were able to improve the profitability, the sales numbers on that, came up with some cool ideas on how to get product out, sitting ready for people to go. And it also helped, a lot dealing with customers. So yeah. I think my background helps me a lot in that side of it too. So,
and so specifically with, I joked before, we got into it around, the financial part of my brain really never turning on. Did that come natural to you? Was it like an interest and then you started to work at it and then you figured out, oh, wow, I'm actually kind of good at this. Like, how did that happen for you in your career?
Well, it's pretty interesting. I guess I always had a fascination with money. I don't know how. I mean, my family, it's not like my parents had tons of money or anything. But early on, I was, gosh, I don't know, as an 11-year-old kid, I had a paper route.
Yep.
And that was like running a little business, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I started with 50 customers, on my bike,
Yep.
and you had to stay on top of it. I had a bill every week that I had to pay and I had to get out to customers and have them pay me. And if something happened or newspaper got wet or something, they complained. So I had to deal with that. Or sometimes I get a phone call and say, hey, our paper came and part of it was missing. And, you know, so I had to run back out and take care of it. So I think, you know, from that side of it, it really is where everything kind of started. And I was 11 years old. I didn't have a whole lot of places to spend my money. So, you know, I started, you know, putting it in a bank and, you know, earning interest. And I like that. I like making more money from my money. Right. Yeah. And as time went, you know, I grew up in Brecksville, and my next oldest brother, he and I ended up having a plain dealer newspaper route that had somewhere between, you know, close to 1,000 customers that we had for it. Yeah, it was big. And we made, you know, a lot of money throughout high school. I mean, we had it through high school. And we had one customer who had a business.
Daily?
This was daily, 7 days a week. Yeah. Yeah.
And 7 a.m., 6 a.m., you're dropping them off?
About 5 o'clock in the morning.
5 a.m., yeah. You're dropping them off. And then you're going to school.
And then we had to be back home so we could be at school on time. You know, so we'd get up at about 5. Newspapers were delivered. We'd throw them in the car. Some of them we'd do together. We had some apartment complexes and some condo complexes that we would split and go do separate buildings. Other ones he was, you know, 2 years older than me. So we would drive, and it was all boxes at the street. But, it was a lot, but, that my mom actually helped us with that, with our billing. We would just send bills out to people, and she would help us bill people. She would write up the bills for us too, because there was so many people. We had a customer who owned a business, lived in Brecksville, you know, very successful, you know, big, a pretty good sized business. But he came out one morning and he said, hey guys, he said, I have a question for you. He said, I don't like walking out here and getting my newspaper from the street, from the box. How much would it cost to have me put it in my door? And I looked over at my brother and I turned to him and I said, well, that would be $100 a month. And he said, okay. He said, handed $100 bill to us. And he said, every month, he said, just add it onto the bill. Okay, all great. Right, a couple of weeks later, the neighbor came out and said, hey, how come pizza gets put in his door? And we said, well, we'll do yours, but it's $100 a month.
That's amazing.
And he was like, oh, I'm good at the street.
I'm good. Yeah.
So, and this is not in, you know, this is a few years ago when $100 really was a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, just kind of a cool thing. So that's really where I started. But then I just had the, I think it just kind of became the natural thing. I, you know, took some business classes in high school. I'll tell you, I did go to college though, and I thought I wanted to be an engineer.
Okay.
But I didn't really like that too well. So I switched to accounting. It just wasn't my cup of tea. I just didn't really enjoy it. Although I do have that like of learning how things work. And, you know, that's why, you know, in my career, I was able to get into some of that because I did have that ability. And I'll give a lot of that to my dad because my dad could fix anything. And, you know, I'd be out there working with him or underneath the sink or downstairs or whatever it might be. You know, I mean, he would fix stuff. So I think I had some of that from him. But the financial side of it just became, you know, what I liked. And, went to, you know, CPA firm and, I knew I didn't want to be a partner at a CPA firm, but I knew it was a good way to learn a lot. And, it was closely held businesses, which, gave me a lot of exposure to how a business runs and what you have to do and all the things that go with it. So I started out. And actually, I know how to do payroll taxes, which is something most people don't know.
Yeah.
And I still, you know, when there's a problem, I get involved in it. So, But I did, you know, financial statements and then audits, and then did some corporate work, and then, you know, individual tax returns. And I think that's carried me through a lot of my career, that I had that opportunity there also. So I think it was a good way for me to start out. And then I went to Scott Fetzer, an internal audit. And that was, you know, going from privately held to these big companies that were part of a bigger corporation, and ultimately Berkshire Hathaway, and, you know, completely a different feel. And, you know, I think I just kind of got hooked, and I've carried through ever since. And I kind of came full circle, though, and I'm back at a privately held company that is a lot of fun, and we're growing like crazy, and tons of opportunities for people here. So that's what I really like.
I love it. Let's shift gears a little bit. I use ChatGPT almost every day for random little tasks mm-hmm. and help. I'm curious to see how you have seen AI start to infiltrate the financial industry. Mm-hmm. I assume it has.
Well, you know what's kind of cool is now when I'll go to Google something, I get the AI assistant that pops up. And at first I was like, boy, this is really annoying. Yeah. But then I started using it a little bit, and I was like, wow, this is really kind of getting me where I want to go a lot quicker without having to do a lot of clicking and reading and closing and opening and all that. So it's been interesting, to say the least. So, I think in the financial side, from a, you know, a business standpoint, a manufacturing company, I think what'll happen, and what already is happening, is that the mundane data entry stuff will have a big impact. Mm-hmm. That will become less important of somebody having to enter that information and the errors that come with it and all that. It actually impacted us a couple years ago with our audit. The accounting firm that we used at that time here at Ramco, they used some AI to help analyze our data to look for the patterns and errors and, you know, that type of thing, the weird anomalies out there, so that they could hone in better on our audit. Mm-hmm. And at first I was like, this is kind of crazy. They just want to spend money on this thing, you know. But after they started doing it, it was like, well, this is kind of cool, because they're coming up with kind of the right places they should be looking. Hmm. So I think that that sifting of the data for them kind of helped open my eyes a couple years ago more to it. The other piece of it is on the forecasting side. I think we're seeing that already, here. Luckily I have a good person who really loves getting into the data, and he's able to help plow through this, and kind of getting some of these things in place to make us better with the, that analysis, using some more advanced tools that, we didn't have before he came on board here. So it helps a lot when you're running through a calculations on inventory that's, you know, I couldn't even tell you how many lines, but more than I like to think about.
Yeah.
That you're doing a big LIFO calculation and comparing, and, you know, he's using some stuff to help, you know, plow through all that with all the different SKUs we have here. So
yeah, I think so far the early trend, regardless of industry, so like audit's a perfect example. Or like a mm-hmm. 80 page report comes out on a state of the industry or something, and you type, mm-hmm. throw that in there and say, hey, give me the highlights, give me the top 10, identify, yep, right. You know, whatever it is. That seems to be the trend. You know, there's a lot of conversations around content creation, moderation, you know, writing, things like
sure.
that.
Right.
Again, there's always the middle ground of like the world's ending and AI is going to take over and all of our jobs are gone. And then, you know, it's not going to have any effect at all. And we're finding our medium here, you know, by 2030, for
right.
sure. It'll be fully integrated.
So.
Right. And the next generation, yep. you know, Gen Z, it'll be, to your point of like Google and Google AI, it'll just be something they know how to operate. And I don't think they'll think anything different. So, yeah, it'll be fascinating to track it. That's for sure.
I think it will. I think it's going to be very interesting. Do I worry about accountants going away and financial people? Not at this point.
Because I don't think anyone's going to fully trust the machine right now. Like, you can use a machine, but I also want you to make sure the machine's right.
Sure, exactly. Yeah. And you know, there's still a lot of feel out there
for
what's the gut tell you. I think that's going to be a premium. Right.
The more people use AI, the more technology comes in, regardless of it. I think a premium is actually going to be the human element of it, regardless of the industry.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I think you're right. I think that's a good way to put it. That's the premium. Yep.
All right, so let's shift gears to, you know, your partnership with Rust Belt. I'd love to learn a little bit about why you decided to partner with Rust Belt and the positives that have come of the partnership so far.
So when we've been a part of the expansion I talked about, both here and in Michigan, was we needed, you know, a lot of people. So we started looking and, you know, we went to our typical sources and we were doing okay using Indeed and that type of thing, but it just wasn't fast enough. We needed people a lot quicker than what we thought we could get there. So I sat down with the HR manager who reports to me, Scott, and I said, you know what? I said, let's figure out who we want to work with and let me see who I know. And I kept pulling up people and saying, you know, let's, you know, we're going to contact him. We're going to contact her. We're going to contact these folks. And one of them I came up, you know, was that I had Rust Belt in the back of my head because I see obviously their posts on LinkedIn. And I said, you know, we're going to contact them because I like their story. It's a good story when you read about it. And I like, you know, the content that was getting out there. So, we then, you know, I got a hold of Taylor or Scott did. I don't remember which one of us, but we talked and he said, you know, if we're going to work together, I want to come out and I want to meet, you know, face to face. I want to, you know, look at each other and see what your operations are all about and see if we do really want to work together. And that's what we did. So Taylor came and Brenna, who works with him there at Rust Belt, we spent, you know, a couple hours together, took them for a tour of the facility. We talked about how we were growing and what our needs were. And it just really felt good. It felt, you know, like a good match. You know, both are very impressive individuals. You know, Taylor's passion is crazy high, right? I mean, he's off the charts with the passion. He loves what he's doing. He has a good story on how he got started and how he's grown and where he wants to go. He loves Northeast Ohio. He wants manufacturing to grow. He wants to be part of that. And, you know, just a fantastic, fantastic passion there. And Brenna was, you know, similar, same thing, you know, because it flows down from Taylor. Yep. And, you know, when we did the plant tour, I mean, there was genuine interest and there was, lots of great questions and awe, you know, which is like, you know, that's how I am. When I come into a new place, I'm looking at something and I'm like, wow, how the heck did they figure this out? You know, and just asking how things went and why does this work like this? And how does, you know, and it was great. So it was just a nice, you know, a nice connection. And then it was after that, you know, said, yeah, we want to all work together. Then we, you know, started talking to Ashley and Hannah and, you know, recruiters. And it wasn't a, you know, 10-minute rush call where they, you know, just tell me what the job is. I'll try to send you some people. It was, tell us about this job.
Yeah.
What about Ramco is special? We heard this from Taylor and we heard this from Brenna. And what else is special about Ramco? What's special about the position? What's the the operations manager, the supervisors, what are they like? What do they want to see in the positions? It's been a nice experience. We've hired some production employees through them. We've hired some mid managers now through them, through Rust Belt, and the follow up is good. We love getting the write ups from the initial contact that they have with a candidate. Where they're matching it up, trying to match up, you know, they have the job description we give them and they're putting notes out there. You can tell that they're really going through things because they're asking the questions of that person. They don't ever just open up a file cabinet, an electronic file cabinet, I should say, and send over resumes. They're out there searching for them.
All right. I'm going to transition a little bit to a, macro question. I'm curious to get your feedback and thoughts on, you know, any positive trends you're seeing in the manufacturing industry over the last, you know, call it 18 to 24 months. You know, you can't live in this state and not hear the word Intel. We've had a ton of conversations around reshoring. We've had conversations around the CHIPS Act. You know, those that and Intel goes hand in hand. What are you seeing just overall of positive trends in manufacturing?
Well, you know, part of what Ramco did was we were a little ahead of the wave of the onshoring because we really started looking at this prior, you know, like right around COVID, I'd say, with, you know, talks about it and kind of getting some plans pulled together. And, COVID kind of came and went somewhat in that short time period. And we started up in, December? Yeah, December of 21, we broke ground. And our building expansion here was done in July of 22. And that was to, you know, reshore, onshore, whatever word you want to use there, Paul. It was expressly for that, to increase the amount of product that we domestically produced. And it just happened that the COVID and the aftermath ended up having some major impacts on lead times. I mean, our lead times from product that we purchase overseas went out to 52 weeks. The cost of freight quadrupled, you know, ocean freight quadrupled. The steel prices overseas increased. The currencies, you know, were all over the place. And it really, for Ramco, it was, that onshoring was super important. And then in the last year and a half, some of the OEMs came to us and said, hey, we want to get as much as we can domestically produced. And, some of them said they wanted to do it in a year, but that was a little too aggressive. But it's the way to go, and I'm happy that we made the investment, you know, before it became you got to do this because I think it would have hurt us, 100%. You know, and we still have more room to grow. We have capacity, and we have more room for more equipment as we, you know, if we come up with some other. Big orders that we need more equipment for, we can do it. We still have some room here, and we still have the ability to grow in the Michigan facility too. We got a little more space up there than what we had at the other three buildings, and we can expand that too. And with expansion building, and we can expand here too. We have more land here here in Hudson. So the onshoring is it's huge, and I don't think that's going to change. Some of the automotives are doing a little more Mexico right now, but that's okay. We're right there. We can ship. We're good doing that. We've been doing it for years. So, but they still want it domestically produced here in North America. Yeah. So we're right in their sweet spot. You know, the, The other thing, you know, you mentioned the chips. I mean, that's been interesting, you know, both from, you know, personally, I think it's been interesting from, you know, investment opportunities, that type of thing too. And it's a great thing for Ohio because, you know, you're bringing in some nice companies that have, you know, people who are getting paid, you know, more money, and that just means that they're going to be able to buy more automobiles. Yep. And other products that, you know, we supply to. Mm-hmm. So it's good to be in America. It's, you know, it's morning in America. Yep. Again, right?
100%. Yeah, that's great. So, last question before we get to the rapid fire, you mentioned some, you know, you still have the capability to grow, maybe some new machines. Will Ramco be investing in any new technologies in the near future?
Yeah, we look at automation for some of the jobs that are harder to fill. You know, they're not as sexy, you know, that type of thing. So if the, you know, with labor, it's still tight. We've been pretty fortunate being able to get people, but it's tight. So we've looked at where can we automate, and we have invested that way, and we continue. We have some other equipment coming in that is set up to have a little more automation on it. And we'll continue to do that. As far as, you know, the process of making the product here, you know, those machines run pretty well. It's all the other processes within that we look at. A lot of, especially a lot on the packing side. I mean, believe it or not, I should have one in here, but I don't have one in here. But I mean, the boxes, you know, they're pretty small. They're that the automotives want everything packaged into. It's not the big bins. Like that's probably the thing that surprised me the most about automotives. They don't want these huge bins. I thought they wanted huge bins and they dump them into, you know, onto their line, but they look at the small boxes that are, you know, I don't remember the weights, but it's not a huge weight, you know, 35, 40 pounds, and people can handle them, and that's what they want. So we have a lot of little boxes all out right there when it's packaged. So the packaging is huge. The barcoding is huge, and the controls to measure the processing of product has been a big investment that we've made, especially in our sorting side. We automated those machines, and we actually cut back on the number of machines we need to run and how many hours we need to run them by measuring the uptime and calculating the OEE, which is the uptime of the machine and the quality and how fast it's running, that type of thing. Yeah. So we automated all that, and it's been a huge success, and we're moving into some other areas now to do more of
that. Awesome. Well, Bob, this was great. We're going to end with our six rapid fire. So, you know, as fast as you can answer them, the better, but, okay. Yeah, so we'll jump in. So first one is best piece of advice you've ever received.
Well, I think, you know, it's the very few of us are smart enough where we don't have to work hard, and that's why we have to continue to work hard. That was something that I got from, you know, he's a friend and my mentor to this day, and he told me that you know, a long time ago. And I think also being humble and you know, not thinking that you're this great thing. I mean, sure, I've got lots of experience. Sure, do I know a lot of things about how to do stuff? Sure, but it's being humble about it and trying to make sure that I pass some of that on to other people, help them grow, and you know, treat everybody the same. It doesn't matter if it's the guy who cuts the grass or pushes the broom. I mean, we're all just, you know, we're all just working, you know, and trying to do our job every day. And hopefully that, you know, people call me sir. And I was like, I'm not a sir. I'm just Bob. That's all I am. I'm nothing special. Yep. So
I love it.
Yeah. I would say that work hard and treat people well and be
We're going to go the opposite direction. What's the worst piece of advice you've ever received?
Okay, so, you know, a lot of times, you know, you hear about, you know, try to get along with everybody and you know, be the bigger person. And I think that, sure, that's the case in a lot of things. And, you know, especially within, you know, within a department or within a company, you have to get along with people. But in a bigger picture, though, you know, in reality, you know, this is how I combat the worst piece of advice, you get along with everybody, is, you know, you have to make sure that if there's negativity out there, you get rid of it. And you get rid of toxic people who you don't want to be around, because somebody told me, again, you know, Bob, my mentor, my friend, you know, you don't have to work with people who you don't like. There's plenty of good people out there who you want to work with. So, you know, the worst advice is you don't always have to get along with somebody. Yeah. And if they're bringing you down, but you get rid of them, you remove
it's
that.
It's funny
toxic.
You say that. It sounds simple, but just be somebody you want to work
sure.
with. Just be somebody you want to work with.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that will take you, you'll survive careers, layoffs, changes,
right.
promotions. You'll survive.
Right.
If you are someone that people enjoy working with, regardless of your point around
right.
how talented you are, how smart you are, how much experience you have,
sure.
that all matters. You can't take that away. But man, it goes a long
right.
way if you're just enjoyable to be around.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And you know, it's important that, you know, my advice is to people is it's important to maintain long-term
yes.
relationships in your network. I mean, I still know people who I talked to from, you know, 30 years ago, who I worked with, and you know, try to maintain that relationship. And, you know, if there's something that you see that might be of interest to somebody or somehow where they could help something, you push it out to them. And you don't worry about something coming back to you from a networking relationship, because it's in the head, you know, it's
yep.
in the heart
no doubt.
That you get a lot out
no
of
doubt.
It that way. You know, it's a group, really. It's a big group. I can't even imagine when our relatives, our ancestors, whenever your family came to America, you know, what they went through, how they even made the decision and said, I'm gonna take the chance, and I'm gonna jump on this boat, and I don't know anybody in America, but I hear it's really a good place. They left their family. They left, you know, maybe they had a business, and it's really inspiring to think mm-hmm. about that. You know, I look at it and I'm like, wow, I don't know if I could do that. You know, I suppose you can do incredible things when your life, maybe, you know, you think about it and you say, hey, you know what? The only way I can help my family is to do this, and I'll catch them back up on it later, right? I mean, that's how they had to have thought. And same thing, you know, with World War II. I mean, the veterans, you know, the guys who went to Europe and you know, to the Pacific. I mean, geez, oh, man, I can't even fathom it. You know, I just can't. And I don't want to cut anybody from any other wars. You know, my dad was in Korean yep. War, and I knew people, you know, in the Vietnam War, and I've known plenty of people who were in the Iraqi, you know, 1990s,
yep.
you know, Kuwait, and more recently in Afghanistan. And, you know, my nephew was just over there in the Middle East for, you know, this whole thing going on in Israel and all that. I mean, it's incredible what they
yep.
go through. So, but you know, one thing that, you know, and my kids would probably say, yeah, he says this all the time, but you know, I look at it and I say, you know, you'd be surprised what you can do, right? I mean, for a week you can
yeah.
do anything, right? A day you can do anything, a week, right? A month, yeah, probably I can do that. A year, okay, yeah, you can do that for a year. You just have to put your mind to it and surprise
sure.
yourself, right? But I mean, that's the inspiration, because I think about that and I'm like, could I really have done that? Could I really have gotten on a boat?
It's hard to your point, like how
come
you said
New York?
It's just hard to fathom. hard to
imagine. It's unfathomable, right?
Okay, next one is favorite restaurants. Could be in Hudson, could be Cleveland, Northeast, Northwest Ohio. Free publicity for any place you love.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, so that I have a couple that that I enjoy. Barrios is a favorite. There's a few of those around. It's easy to get to. My boys like it. You know, too. I mean, they're grown, but that's a great place to go to. There's a place in Kasai that's in Wadsworth called Kasai, and it's nice. Sushi. Love it. I mean, absolutely love it. Used to live over in Granger Township in Medina County, and it was right, 10 minutes away, and we'd get sushi there all the time. And they have another place in Green for the people who are a little further south, but it's a great awesome. Sushi place. And then don't get to go here often, but Angelo's Pizza in Lakewood is real, great.
I say this all the time. Anytime a guest brings up pizza, I always say Cleveland crushes Columbus pizza.
Oh yeah. There's so many great places, right?
It crushes the pizza.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Hopefully, there's some good entertaining things here. It's a little interesting for people, and we'll see how it all goes. We'll see where the ratings go on it.
You can go to Taylor for that question.
But it's fun. I've enjoyed this, Paul. It's been a nice thing to do, something different. And who knows? Maybe I'll start my own podcast and ask you for some. I'll ask you for some help.
There it is.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Rust Belt Rundown. Make sure you check us out at rustbeltrecruiting.com. The Rust Belt Rundown is available wherever you listen to your podcasts. Make sure to hit that subscribe button and click on 5 stars if you enjoyed this episode. See you next time.